Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books Network channel, New Books in South Asian Studies. I am Kshitij Jain, a master's student at the University of Oxford. And in this episode, we are hosting Dr. Eva de Klerk from Ghent University, who will be discussing her recently published work, The Life of Padma, which has been published under the Murthy Classical Library of India of Harvard University. Dr. Eva de Klerk is an associate professor at the Department of Indian Languages and Cultures of Ghent University. She completed her MA and PhD from Ghent University in Oriental Languages and Cultures. Her PhD dissertation is on Swayambhu Deva's Paumcharyu, a 10th century Jain Ramayana written in Apabhramsha, which she translated into 5 volumes. And out of these 5 volumes, the first 2 volumes have been published by the Murthy Classical Library under the title The Life of Padma in the years 2018 and 2023 respectively. Apart from Paumcharyu, Dr. de Klerk's interests include other Apabhramsha texts, Apabhramsha and Jain literary culture, and the history of Jains as portrayed in Apabhramsha texts. Thank you very much, ma'am, for accepting our invite and being on New Books Network today. I look forward to having a fruitful discussion with you.
Thank you.
So to begin with the discussion, ma'am, can you please tell the audience about how you got interested in Paumcharyu? And what was your objective behind translating such a voluminous text, and how your experience as a translator has been?
Yeah. I started, actually, I wanted to study Sanskrit and Sanskrit literature when I was 18 years old, coming out of high school. And actually, my primary interest was in the Sanskrit epics. I enjoyed Greek and Latin literature. I didn't have any prospect at the time in terms of what I wanted to be, what I wanted to do for an occupation. So I thought, why not? I went to India when I was 18 years old. I came back and decided, okay, sure, I will study Sanskrit. So I enrolled at Ghent University, just started from there. Then by the time of my master's dissertation, I had to choose a subject, and for that I chose Ramayana, and I focused on the Valmiki Ramayana and the Vali Vadha episode, the death of Valin. Enjoyed myself greatly, and then later on I thought, I want to do more of this work. I found out that you could do a PhD and actually be paid to do this kind of work, reading these texts and translating them and studying them. And then together with my supervisor, who was Frank van den Bossen, he's a specialist in Jain philosophy. He doesn't really know that much about narrative literature, but we kind of looked at what Jain, because Jainism was a speciality actually in the department where I got my degree and where I registered to do a PhD. So I mean, it just came very as like a very natural to decide on doing a Jain version of the Ramayana. And then it was the choice. We had some editions in the library. There was the editions of the Paumacharyam by Vimala Suri. We didn't have Ravishena's text at the time, the Padma Purana. And then there was also these, 3 small volumes of the edition of the Paumacharyu in Apabhramsha, edited by Bhayani. And honestly, I mean, it came to a choice of doing either the Prakrit version by Vimala Suri. And I have to say, I mean, we had for 2 years, we had Prakrit classes, and I really enjoyed reading Prakrit. It kind of, to me, it felt like kind of a step up from Sanskrit. I guess, this had to do with this, this adolescent tendencies of, Sanskrit was no longer peculiar enough, and I wanted to do something more special. So I thought, why not Prakrit? And then, given the opportunity of doing Apabhramsha, which was even more peculiar than Prakrit, then I went for the Apabhramsha, basically. That's how I got to choose the Paumacheryu, and I basically had to teach myself the grammar. Of course, Apabhramsha grammar is to a high degree very similar actually to Prakrit, and when you have a basis of Prakrit, you can manage, and I could manage with the the grammars that were available. And I started reading, and I have to say, there hasn't been a day in my life since, there was 1999 when I decided on Paumacheryu. I haven't regretted it for even a day in my life. It's such a it's really, it's such a beautiful text. I enjoy it every time I read excerpts or I read passages. I something else catches my eye. And to me, it's just, the pleasure and the joy of, being able to just work on that text and read it. I guess that's it.
Thanks for sharing your journey, ma'am. And as Paumacheryu is a part of Jain Ramayana tradition, so can you tell our audience a bit more about the Jaina Ramayana tradition and locate Paumacheryu within it?
Yeah, okay. So, well, as you may know, the Ramayana itself has, in fact, in pre-modern times, has this enormous diversity of, there are so many different versions of the story that have been composed, that have been written by, you have also versions in the pictorial arts that are there. And also the Jains, they also created their own versions of these stories. And they are quite peculiar in the sense that, they really kind of show them or kind of demonstrate their own version as what they call, the true version. They indicate certain inconsistencies in what they, what they consider inconsistencies in the version of the Valmiki Ramayana. And they say, this is a wrong version. We will now tell our true version. So this is kind of a tendency that you find in all of the Jain Ramayanas. So where does the Paumacheryu fit in? Well, actually, it follows the narrative. The first Jain Ramayana that we have is that of Vimalasuri, right? This is in Prakrit, the Paumacheryam. Then this Prakrit version was transcreated, you could say. It was the same story was reproduced a few centuries later by Ravishena in Sanskrit. And then the next in line was Swayambhusi, is the third one, to rework Ravishena's text. And he is, Swayambhu is explicit about his source being Ravishena. So this text, this Padma Purana or Padma Charita by Ravishena, is very much a text of high authority for Digambara Jains. Yeah, they consider it part of their secondary canon, is sometimes a term used for it. Each of these texts, Vimalasuri's and Ravishena's texts, each of them have their own merit as kavyas, as works of literature. It's interesting to compare the three, because you can kind of see how, the differences are often small, but not insignificant, and it kind of it makes it quite clear how the poet was thinking and what he wanted to convey to his audience in a different way compared to the source. But I'm going on and on, so I'll leave it here for this question.
Thanks for the answer, ma'am. And to continue with what you said, that there are the differences are less in number, but they are not insignificant. So I would like to know that what are the major points of differences between the Valmiki Ramayana and Paumacheryu, especially in terms of events as well as the treatment of characters like Jatayu, Shambhuk, and Shuparnakha.
Yeah, of course, that's something I left out of my answer to the previous question. Of course, there is this element of, what makes these works, you know, Jain Ramayanas. And actually, you could say that in the storyline, the Jain Ramayanas, or at least of the Paumacharyu, it's not that different compared to the Valmiki Ramayana in the sense that, you know, it talks about this prince of Ayodhya called Rama, who is ousted from the kingdom through intrigues of Kaikeyi, of his stepmother. He, together with Sita Lakshmana, they go to this vanavas to reside in the jungle. And Sita is then abducted by Ravana. And then the rest of the story is about how Rama connects with the Vanaras and they go and retrieve Sita. So that is, I mean, therein the story is the same. What is a major difference is, I guess, probably the foremost is the characterization of the Vanaras and the Rakshasas. So in the Valmiki, even in the Valmiki Ramayana, you know, as far as the Vanaras are concerned, they are monkeys, they are a monkey people, but at the same time, you know, there are monkeys who can talk. So, I mean, you can't really call them ordinary monkeys, right? Also not in the Valmiki Ramayana. But anyway, the Jains kind of clarify this dubious identity of the Vanaras, and they consider them to be humans. They say, you know, they are called the Vanaras, but it's all a misunderstanding. It's not because they are monkeys, they are actually a people. They are a race, if you will. And they are called the Vanaras because they have a monkey as the emblem of their flag. Which all sounds very logical. And, you know, they had an ancestral island where their dynasty, this Vanara Vamsha, was initiated. And that was on the Vanara Dvipa, Vanara, you know, monkey island, an island that was inhabited by monkeys. And they had good relationships with these monkeys, etc. So that explains the identity of the Vanaras. And then for the Rakshasas, you have a kind of a similar explanation. They are also considered humans. Just like you and I, and they are called, I mean, for the explanation of the name of Rakshasa, different texts give different explanations. One is that one of the ancestors, and actually the progenitor of the Rakshasa Vamsha, the dynasty, was called Rakshas. And so the Rakshasas is the Sanskrit Vridhi form, the descendants of Rakshas. So that is one. And then there is also this link that is made to a kind of avidya, a kind of special power that members of this Rakshasa dynasty possess. And it's called the Rakshasi Vidya. So Rakshasa also means something literally as, you know, protective or protecting. And then the two combined, the Vanaras and the Rakshasas, you know, I mentioned the Vidya. So they are both sub-branches of a larger dynasty called the Vidyadhara Vamsha. And the members of this dynasty, they're just regular humans. And what is special about them is that they possess vidyas. And vidyas are, in the Jain texts, are a kind of, it's often translated as genie, in the sense that it is a supernatural power. That, you know, the one who possesses that power can summon the power through some kind of through meditation or by kind of through a mental activity. And that power then appears before you in a feminine form, in an embodied feminine form, and will do whatever you ask the power to do, and it will do whatever it can within its power. So that is there. And then another, I think, major difference is the fact that Ravana, he is not killed by Rama, but he is in fact killed by Lakshmana. So, and this has to do with this universal history of the Jains, where so according to the Jains, how they describe history is through biography, the biographies of the 63 great men, is Shalaka Purushas or Mahapurushas, and in this group of 63, the characters of Rama, Lakshmana, and Ravana are included, and they follow a kind of blueprint of the Baladeva Vasudeva and Prativasudeva. So Rama is the Baladeva, Lakshmana is the Vasudeva, and Ravana the Prativasudeva. And because of this kind of blueprint, it is Lakshmana who has to kill, you know, he is the enemy of the Prativasudeva and has to kill them. So that, I mean, in general terms, what is really Jain about the Jain Ramayanas. But of course, yeah, you also have these, you know, these episodes. I mean, each of the kind of significant episodes and characters, as you mentioned, Jatayu and, you know, the Shambhuka, they're also changed and kind of, you know, the authors really took the opportunity to transform the story. So for instance, the character of Jatayu, of course, for the Jains, Jatayu being a vulture is considered, you know, a very kind of impure bird that eats the cadavers of other animals. So their meeting with Jatayu occurs at a point where in the story where Rama, Sita, and Lakshmana have just met two Jain Munis, and then this bird passes by, and the bird faints when seeing the Munis, and then the Munis, they explain, you know, they explain the previous life story of this bird, and then, you know, we get the story of how he once was a king who basically who killed many Jain monks in his previous life, and for that reason, in his next life, he was reborn as a vulture. So that is the story of Jatayu. That is kind of, you could call it Jainified, or, you know, it's kind of poured into a Jain mold of with previous birth stories are very popular among the Jains. And then the character of Shambhuka, the way they treat that is, I think, is very interesting. Jatayu is not really, I think, in any Ramayana story, a kind of a controversial figure. But this character of Shambhuka is very much, you know, the Shambhuka Vadha in the Valmiki Ramayana, you know, it occurs quite at the end of the story where you have this Shudra who is performing penance. And then, you know, he's basically, I mean, his performance of penance causes some disturbance to the cosmos, and it caused this Brahmin child to die, and for that reason he is killed by Rama. He's basically killed, and I mean, it is an episode that we see that later authors, yeah, have kind of made additions to it because they, I guess, they found it perhaps cruel the way this Shambhuka was treated. And also the Jains, you know, they're not explicit about, I guess, about, you know, Rama's killing of Shambhuka, but they kind of, this is how I feel at least, they kind of try to emancipate the character of Shambhuka by bringing him forward into the narrative. So in the Jain story, Shambhuka is actually, he is the son of Shurpanakha, who is in the Jain text called Chandranaka or Chandanahi in the Apabhramsha form. So the way this happens is, you know, Rama, Sita, and Lakshmana, they've settled in the forest. And then one day, Lakshmana goes out and he goes walking around in the forest. And all of a sudden, he sees a magical sword hovering in the air above a kind of a bamboo bush. Of course, he can't resist. He grabs the sword and then he wants to kind of try out and see if this is a good sword. And he hacks into that bamboo bush. And then when he pulls back the sword, the head of a young boy falls out. And so what happened was that this young boy was in fact Shambhuka. So we have, you know, the same story that he is decapitated. This happens, but it was all an accident. It was not done by Rama. It was done by Lakshmana. But this Shambhuka was the son of Shurpanakha, who had come to the Dandaka forest to meditate in order to get this magical sword. And this was actually, I mean, by accident, it's kind of fate that Lakshmana just happened to walk by when the boy was on at the end of his meditation and the sword had just appeared above him. So, of course, Lakshmana thinks, oh no, what have I done? He goes back to Rama and Sita and explains, and, you know, Rama and Sita are like, oh no, what have you done? This is terrible. And then comes Shurpanakha. So Shurpanakha is actually is kind of, she is in the forest for the purpose of visiting her son, because she knows, okay, you know, this is supposed to be the day when he will have this sword. And then she finds her boy dead, you know, and clearly murdered. And she goes, initially she goes crazy with sadness, but then in the distance, when she you know, Rama and Lakshmana, especially Rama, you know, catches her eye, and she is immediately overcome with passion and falls in love with him. And this is kind of, you know, the tragedy, how the tragedy of Kama, according, you know, in the Jain view, how, you know, even when you've just lost your child, Kama can just befall you at any time. So anyway, I mean, the story then kind of proceeds as it does in the Valmiki Ramayana. She approaches Rama, is rejected both by Rama and by Lakshmana. There's no real episode of her attacking Sita. She is rejected and then basically runs and flees to Lakshmana and to give them the news of, you know, I've been here attacked by these two men. And she also says, you know, okay, and they killed my son, they killed Shambhuka. And what we will have in the rest of the narrative is that sort of the motivation for the war, it's about, of course, it's about Sita being abducted by Ravana, that is there. But kind of the motivation for Ravana, not just to give Sita back, he kind of, there is this extra motivation of avenging his relatives, avenging the death of Shambhuka, who was killed by Lakshmana. And so in this way, Shambhuka also becomes kind of a catalyst to the, you know, the eventual war with the Rakshasas.
Thanks for the answer, ma'am, and drawing a very detailed sketch of the characters who have a peculiar story in the Jain Ramayana. So let's also talk about the anti-hero Ravana. And why do you think that the Jain authors were sympathetic of Ravana, and why they chose to portray a very nuanced character of him rather than just simply painting him as an evil anti-hero?
Yeah, that is a very interesting fact, how, you know, this Ravana, so first and foremost, of course, he is human. He is, in fact, you know, he is a great hero, right? I mean, the first part of the story, you know, even before the birth of Rama, we have chapters upon chapters dealing with the successes, the great successes of Ravana. In this Jain worldview, again, Ravana being the Prativasudeva makes him, just like the Vasudeva Lakshmana later on, it makes him an Ardha Chakravartin, so a half Chakravartin, so meaning that basically he is a hugely successful political ruler, you know, ruling half of the civilized world, basically. And again, I mean, I think it's, you know, part of this effort of the Jains to kind of want to rationalize, if you will, the story in its entirety. You know, Ravana is a human, and he has all of these extraordinary qualities. He is great at, you know, meditative practice, at ascetic practice, and in many aspects, he is really a great Jain lay person. But he has this great flaw, and his major flaw is Kama, is, you know, he has a problem with, you know, succumbing to passion from the women. And I think what's interesting also to mention is that when Ravana dies, okay, he goes to hell for his sins, for what he has done. But in his future existence, in one of his future existences, he will become a Tirthankara. His soul will become a Tirthankara.
Thank you for the answer, ma'am. And thank you for telling us about a bit more about the character of Ravana. My next question is related more to the ideological side of Paumcharyu and Jain narrative tradition at large. And can you please tell us, and do you think that the Jain Ramayana narrative and the Jain Puranic literature at large is a counter tradition to the Hindu Puranic tradition, as pointed out by Padmanabh Jaini? So do you agree with this statement? And if yes, how do you think it is a counter tradition?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that, you know, at least in its when they started to produce these texts called Puranas, that simply by also naming them Puranas, they were countering or kind of offering an alternative to the Hindu Puranas. And it kind of, I guess this is what Padmanabh Jaini explains, it kind of parallels the growth and the rise in interest and in popularity of these Hindu Puranas, I guess from, you know, the Gupta period and onwards. And also in the titles of the works, you know, there is a famous, you know, one of the Mahapuranas and among the of the Hindus is called Padma Purana, the Lotus Purana. And they use the same term, Padma Purana, to refer as the term for the Jain Ramayanas. And then, you know, they have the main character. They refer to him as Padma. Now, I have to say, in the Paumacharyu, actually, it's only in the title that the character is called Padma, not throughout the text. And this is very different compared to, for instance, Ravishena, where he is indeed called Padma. But also, for instance, Harivamsa Purana. I mean, there is the Hindu Harivamsa Purana, which is this, you know, this kila, this appendix to the Mahabharata. And there is also Jain Harivamsa Puranas, which tell the story of the Jain Krishna, and then also include, you know, stories of Neminatha, the 22nd Tirthankara, etc. So, I mean, that is one aspect. And also in the works itself, you will sometimes find explicit rejections of the Hindu tradition. As I mentioned, it is there in Paumacharyu as well, you know, where they say, oh, you know, what is there in the, they mostly call it the worldly tradition, Laukika, the worldly tradition. It's all a misunderstanding. And then they sum up some events. How is it possible that monkeys build a bridge? How can that be, you know? Or the description of Kumbhakarna. How is it possible for any being to sleep for 6 months and then to devour, I don't know, buffaloes and everything that passes by? This is just not possible. It's contrary to reality. So they give these kind of, so in that sense, they do suggest that, you know, what they are doing is counter to something else. But that said, you know, these were texts and these were stories that also kind of gained popularity among the Jains in their Jain versions. And in their origin, they are definitely, you know, counters for this other Puranas. But then you could say that later on, you know, they kind of became more than just a counter tradition. It became something really popular among the Jains as well.
Thank you for the answer, ma'am. And in relation with this, I would like to ask you that, how can we see an exposition of Jain philosophy and worldview in the writings of Svayambhudeva?
Jain worldview, of course, I mean, the story itself is part of, you know, what has been called the Jain universal history. Kind of the history of the universe, of the cosmos. So of course that is already part of doctrine, if you like. Then, I mean, we do find in several places We have the characters meeting up with Munis, with Jain monks, and then these Munis will give some lecture. So there will be, in the narrative will kind of be interrupted. You will have these points of rest where you have some explanation on the vows, etc. So that is there. And of course, the stories itself, you have previous birth stories of all the characters. And so in that sense, for, you know, when you have the stories of the previous birth and then what happens in their last birth before, you know, either going to hell or obtaining obtaining moksha, obtaining liberation, they are a kind of demonstration of how karma works according to, you know, to the Jain tradition. So in that sense, you can also call them didactic stories of, you know, karma theory. But all in all, I mean, it's not like you don't have to. I mean, this is, I guess, how this was my expectation. And this can be, you know, the expectation of many people when they think about Jain literature. Then they think about philosophy and it must be like very heavy and kind of dry. But this is totally not the case in this narrative literature. And also in this Jain Ramayanas, you know, the elements of that are really, you know, these intermezzos where you have these monks giving some sermon are relatively small and short. You know, it's all very much balanced, and it's still first and foremost it is kavya. It tries to appeal to people, right? And you don't appeal to most people if with any literary work if you make it too dry or too, you know, uninteresting to follow. So the message is conveyed, it's in there, but I think, you know, the poets took great care to do this in a balanced way.
Thank you, ma'am. I would also quote one of your lines in the introduction to the first volume, where you say that in Paumcharyu, the fight between Rama or Lakshman and Ravana is not a fight between good and bad, but only a result of karma. So in this perspective, how is the approach of Swayambhu Deva different than Valmiki?
Yeah, I mean, well, we have this, of course, you know, the story of the battle and Lakshmana killing Ravana. It's all how it is in the Jain story. So we have this event, right? And then it's only afterwards when they, especially Rama and Lakshmana, come to the realization and we get the narration. Again, it's done by a Jain Muni who visits Ayodhya, and we get the narration of how the lives or the souls, if you will, of Rama, Lakshmana, Ravana, and also Sita have been intertwined for so many lifetimes, you know, for so many lifetimes they were characters, and for so long they were animals who were just killing each other again and again and again and again. And it kind of, you know, it resulted ultimately in this kind of final birth. Of course, Rama was the first to kind of get some, how to say, you know, to progress on the path. So before his birth, his last birth, he was already kind of karmically in a better condition compared to Lakshmana and Ravana, because Lakshmana and Ravana, they both basically go to hell for their violence. Whereas Rama, he reaches enlightenment. But I mean, again, yeah, indeed, it's more of this emphasis is really on this, yeah, karmic intertwining of beings rather than, yeah, just good versus evil. That is kind of the backstory that is there, this whole karmic narrative behind it. But at the same time, you know, of course, yeah, there is, I guess, audiences still like some, they still like some violence at the proper time, right? And so again, in a balanced way, it is there. All of these things, the you know, the Vira Rasa, the Shringara Rasa, it's all there, as it should be.
Thank you, ma'am, for your answer. And my next question would be about Paumcharyu. So what are some of the specialties of literary style of Swayambhudeva? And how do you think Paum Charyu has a special place in the history of Apabhramsha literature?
Well, how I mean, comparing, you know, Paum Charyu to, for instance, the Padma Purana by Ravishena or the Paum Charyam of Vimalasuri, he seems to kind of try to perhaps reduce, you know, he cuts out some things, makes some things shorter, to allow him to elaborate on, you know, on certain images, on certain, he kind of paints pictures of a situation or yeah, almost like a kind of a small painting. And he does that by, you know, frequently by using, you know, the simile, so, and the similes and metaphors. So it's highly ornate, without being too heavy, at least in my opinion. Of course, I mean, what we see as something new in Apabhramsha literature compared to, you know, the previous times, Apabhramsha works with the rhyming padas. So you have this end rhyme that is used, you know, all the time, as you find it for those of you who know Braj Bhasha or you know, Avadhi, that also displays this rhyme. So that is there, makes it kind of much more melodious, I guess. Yeah, and where he fits in, Swayambhu, in, you know, the history of Apabhramsha literature. Well, I mean, of Apabhramsha, you know, compared to Sanskrit, certainly not so many texts have survived. And Swayambhu was already renowned during his lifetime, so he calls himself in his text Kaviraja, so king among poets, and he is referred to by later authors also as Kaviraja, as one of the great three Kavirajas of Apabhramsha, so together with Pushpadanta and Chaturmukha. And yes, I mean, I personally very much agree that he is one of the great poets of Indian literature, and certainly, you know, worthy of attention from the people. And, you know, his work is really, yeah, it's really a great experience just to read.
Sorry, I was on mute. Can you tell us, ma'am, your favorite episode or one of your favorite episodes from Paum Charyu?
Oh gosh, that's a difficult one. there is the, I mean, the, I can tell you what the story, the episode is that he is most famous for. That is the you know, the Jalakrida episode, the water sports of Sahasrakirana. That is in a part actually of the life of Ravana. So Ravana is, he's grown up. He has become a king. He has become an Ardha Chakravartin. Or, I mean, he's in the process of becoming the Ardha Chakravartin, and then he goes on his Digvijaya, you know, he goes on his conquest of the world. And we're actually reading this with the students right now. And so he settles his army on the banks of the river Narmada, just, you know, to stay for a few nights and rest. And then on the across the river, there is the city of Maheshwara, which is also a city, Mahesara, in on the banks of the Narmada, and there you have this king Sahasrakirana, and he goes on this he has, it's springtime, and of course then kings in this classical Indian world, they go and have for some jalakrida, for some water sports with his queens. So it's very much, it's highly Sringara rasa. Yeah, it's very, you know, it's very beautiful. So, I mean, the water sports are so wonderful that even the gods in heaven are watching and are amazed by, you know, what this king and his queens are doing. So, and, you know, there you have this description, and then, you know, in the end, after they are done with their water sports, they kind of, so they had put these contraptions, these yantras into the water to kind of create an area of the water where The water would be still, so they, you know, they could relax there. And then they remove these contraptions, and what happens is that the water then rushes on, and it rushes and where to the place where just a bit further Ravana was actually doing a puja to an icon of the Jinna that he had brought, kind of, and he kind of, you know, destroys that puja. And that is the story. That is how it's I mean, it's not really the story. It's just, you know, you have to read it to kind of get a taste. That is the most famous, and my personal favorite story. Yeah, probably the Shambhuka story, that episode.
In the Valmiki Ramayana, ma'am, there are several episodes where the reader faces moral ethical problems, like whether it is in the exile of Rama or in the episode of Vali Vadha, there are moral and ethical problems in those episodes. So do you think that that in Paumcharyu, Swayambhu Deva provides an alternative solution or an alternative approach to these ethical problems?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, as far as the Vali Vadha episode is concerned, they don't really discuss Vali Vadha, you know, the death of, of course, I mean, a major, well, there are actually several issues with the Vali Vadha episode. If you think about it, you know, there is the fact, of course, first and foremost, that Rama is standing behind the bush. He is hidden while Valin is, you know, is fighting with Sugriva. And then he shoots Valin in the back. That is, I mean, the way that the Jains just changes, I mean, the adversary of Sugriva, he just, I mean, Rama does, it is actually Rama who kills him, but this is not, I mean, he's not hidden. So there is no issue there. He was, I mean, there was a battle, but it was an open battle. So in that sense, there is no problem. But underlying that, you have this issue that Rama kills Valin, and Valin is the brother, or the half-brother at least, of Sugriva. But actually, Sugriva was asking another person to kill his own brother. How can Sugriva then be considered a good character, right? Yeah. I mean, it's a stain on the character of Sugriva, even though his brother, you know, did harm him and did, you know, cause him pain. Still, you know, having your brother killed is it's serious, and that is something that the Jains also change in this story. So they actually change the character of Valin. So Valin and Sugriva are brothers, but Valin, long before even the birth of Rama, had decided to become a Jain monk, and he went away. So actually, there is this adversary of Sugriva, but it is a Maya Sugriva. It is some otherwise unknown character, a Vidyadhara, who has the power to change transform his appearance, and he transforms his appearance into kind of like a double of Sugriva, Maya Sugriva. And so when Sugriva then asks Rama, can you please help me in getting rid of this adversary? He's no longer asking him to please kill my brother. So this is how they change this moral problem here.
Sure. Thank you for the answer, ma'am. And one allegation which Jainas put on Hindu narratives in almost all their Puranas and narrative literature, whether it is Padma Purana or it is Harivansh Puran, is that the Brahmanical Purans are filled with inconsistencies or filled with fantastic descriptions which are not possible. But were they aware of the self-contradictory problem that the Jain narratives also consider are full of fantastic descriptions which are just a long shot of imagination and they cannot be considered true? So were they aware of this contradiction, and did they try to address it?
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting question. This is something that, you know, I guess is sometimes overemphasized about these Jain versions. You know, it's all about getting rid of inconsistencies and making the story more rational somehow. To a degree, this is certainly true, but it is, as you say, you know, okay, so the monkeys did not build a bridge or a dam to cross an army to Lanka. No, they actually flew in their vimanas, in flying celestial chariots. You could say that, yeah, how is this possible, a celestial chariot? Is this any more logical than you know, than monkeys building a bridge? Yeah, so I think this is, you know, it's something that scholars tend to want to overemphasize, this logical element. As I mentioned, it's there to a degree, but it's mostly about internal inconsistencies. That is something, and this is what is interesting, is something, it is something that you also see in philosophy and in philosophical debates. It's not so much, of course, there is the inconsistency with reality and what is, you know, possible in real life, or what we have already observed as something or experienced in real life. But on the other hand, I feel it's much more about wanting to create a coherent story, a coherent narrative. And this is exactly what they do, you know, compared, of course, you know, when stories, the Ramayana, the text of the Ramayana and the text of the Mahabharata, have been, you know, elaborated on for many centuries, and naturally in such a process certain inconsistencies do come up, so, but this is just due to the way these texts were formed, whereas, you know, these Jain texts, they were basically conceived of and written down, composed by one single author. So, you know, you have much less of a risk of this internal inconsistencies there. But of course, they like to point out the inconsistencies that are there in these other theories, in these other, you know, versions.
Thank you for the answer, ma'am. And my next question is that, why did the Jainas feel this need to engage with the Ramayana tradition in such an extensive way? Because they produce so many different versions in not only Sanskrit and Prakrit, but in vernaculars like maybe Apabhramsha or maybe Kannada. And the second part of my question is that what can we assess the contribution of the Jain authors in popularization and enriching of Ramayana tradition?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Well, I think first and foremost, the great diversity of Jain Rama stories just has to do with, you know, it's a reflection of the great diversity of the Ramayanas in general. You know, I think there's no story that's more popular and that has been told more often in South Asia and beyond, I think, than the story of Rama. You know, there's thoughts, there's ideas about why it became more popular than other stories. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I you know, I've been reading Ramayanas for, you know, over half my life now. And I think, yes, it's a relatively simple story. In fact, you have a prince and princess. Princess is abducted, and then prince goes and retrieves the princess again. But yeah, so I think when you talk about the Jain Ramayanas and their, you know, the fact that there are so many of them, I think you have to see that within the broader Ramayana tradition. It's the Ramayana that's basically so popular, and people, there was an audience for that. That is one thing. And then what is the contribution of the Jains to this, you know, the Jain Ramayanas? Well, you can see that in I think, you know, you can split this. You can also ask, what is the contribution of the Jains to literature? You know, they I think Jains, perhaps more than any other community in India, they have been wealthy, generally a wealthy community throughout history as merchants. So they had They had funding, they had money to kind of spend on culture and spend on literature and on writing and on copying texts, which they did. So that makes them very important as, you know, as preservers of South Asian heritage, South Asian literary heritage, not just Jain literature, of course. First and foremost, they were preserving Jain literature, but it was more than that. It was wider than that. But then, I mean, if we look at the Jain Ramayanas more specifically, there are certain aspects, certain elements of the Jain Ramayanas that were taken over by other authors that we see also in other versions. So, for instance, what is it? Well, this character of Shambhuka, right? That was actually, you find that in non-Jain versions as well. That's Shambhuka being the son of Shurpanakha. You find it in Tamil versions. What else is there off the top of my head? There's the characterization of Ravana as, you know, Ravana is called Dashamukha, you know, the one with the 10-faced one, and in the Valmiki Ramayana, or in this, you know, the more what we would call orthodox Hindu versions, he really has the 10 faces, yeah, and 20 arms. But then according to the Jains, the fact that he is called the 10-faced one is because when he was a child, he got hold of some of a very special necklace, and his, so he put on the necklace and his face reflected in the 9 gems of the necklace, and it appeared to his relatives as though he had 10 faces. He didn't really, but he just got the name the 10-faced one because of it. And I know there's other versions who actually use this same account. And I believe some years ago there was this TV show called Ravana, and it was really focused on Ravana, and I was surprised to see that episode was in there. I don't know where, you know, the script writers got it, whether they got it from the Jain version. Probably not. Maybe there's some other text, but yeah. So it's, I mean, it's in this kind of details that you do find elements, you know, narrative elements that make it clear that these texts were perhaps read more widely than just only by the Jain audiences.
Thank you for the answer, ma'am. And I feel that I have already asked a lot of questions to you. But just as a final question, that because this is a very voluminous work and because translation is always a challenge, so what challenges did you face while translating Paumcharyo?
I mean, of course, initially the challenge, you know, had to do with the language of Apabhramsha, and there still are for Prakrit and for Apabhramsha. There are very few resources, you know, in terms of dictionaries and grammars. So that was in itself a challenge. What greatly helped me along is the fact that there was this Prakrit text and this Sanskrit text, you know, that was the source of for Swayambhu. So I, you know, often I first read the Sanskrit version, and then, you know, when some things were not clear, this could really help me reconstruct or kind of construct what specific Apabhramsha words meant. So that is one. Of course, you know, this is a text that was composed more than 1,000 years ago, somewhere in the Deccan. I'm not from India, so I could say I'm not from India, it's not my world. But even people living in India nowadays, you still have the gap of 1,000 years ago, you know, you have, I mean, so it took time, but I think, and this is my personal experience, but I think other people experience it as well. You know, if you really immerse yourself into a text, into an author for, you know, many, many weeks and months and years, you kind of, that kind of makes it easier to kind of, you become somehow familiar. It's almost an intuitive thing. That kind of arises somehow in even though I live, you know, on the other side of the world compared to India, and there's 1,000 years between us. I do think that this is something that kind of naturally can occur. I think that's the most important.
Would you like to share some of your forthcoming or future research projects which the audience might be interested in?
Of course, I do plan to publish the translation of the rest of the poem Acheryu. I did this for my PhD. This was over 20 years ago that I did my first translation. But in those days, when you did a PhD here in Belgium, you still had to do it in the local language. So it was in Dutch. And I'm just basically in the last few years have been reworking the translation. And, you know, one thing I do have to say, and this also connects to the previous question, is that I received a lot of help from, you know, the editors of the Murti Classical Library, and, you know, the work that they're doing is really, I felt so supported in what they did. You know, they really went through the text together with me. There is that. I will continue working on that. Other work, I have also been working on a 15th century author called Raidhu. He wrote a lot of Apabhramsha works, and all of them are much shorter. It seems that, you know, from this period onwards, and, you know, post 10th century, some authors seem to prefer to write shorter texts. I think, you know, it would be nice to maybe do an edition of some of his works if texts have not been edited. I'm reading some of Pushpadanta's work with some colleagues, which is very enjoyable and hopefully might lead to future projects. So yes, I will. Basically, my plan is to continue very much in Apabhramsha literature.
All right. So I think we should conclude this interview with this. Thank you very much, Dr. Declercq, for sparing your valuable time and being here on New Books Network. It was a great pleasure hosting you. We wish you all the very best for your upcoming academic endeavors, and we look forward to the other volumes of Poem Churio 2. Thank you very much, and thanks for joining us today on New Books Network.
Thank you, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about my work.
Thank you so much, ma'am.
Thanks.